Hello and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs, and I am joined by my co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we are super excited today to talk about flow trial with semaglutide in people with type 2 diabetes and kidney disease. And this was just published in the New England Journal of Medicine and recently presented. And so, Natalie, can you walk us through what is the flow trial?
Thanks, Diana. Welcome, everyone. So we've done a lot of different trials using GLP-1s in the last few years, looking at effects on other complications from diabetes. We're looking at it in cardiovascular outcomes. We're looking at it in renal outcomes. We're looking at it in MASH. So this is a study, the FLOW trial is what it was called. Inclusion of FLOW trial, patients needed to have, these were people with renal problems, with kidney problems, a eGFR of 50 to 75. So, with as well as a urinary albumin to creatinine ratio, which we call UACR, of greater than 300, but less than 5,000, or an eGFR of 25 to less than 50, and an UACR, of greater than 100 and less than 5,000. So they picked out people that had some chronic kidney disease. It's not stage 5, it's not severe, but they definitely had chronic kidney disease. And the primary outcome of interest, what are we looking for the trial, was major kidney disease events. And they grouped them together. So, and they defined it as dialysis, transplantation, an eGFR decline to less than 15, or a reduction of 50% of greater in that eGFR from baseline, or death from kidney-related or cardiovascular causes. They included a bevy of secondary outcomes of interest, which were tested hierarchically. A couple more sentences.
All right.
Cool. So in total, there were a little over 3,500 patients that were recruited from this amazing number, 387 sites across 28 countries. The cohort mean age was 66 years, 69% male, 65% non-Hispanic whites. And the median follow-up time was 3.4 years when the trial was stopped early due to these incredible outcomes that we found. And a little over 1,700 people were randomized to the semaglutide arm, and a little over 1,700 were randomized to placebo. So, Diana, that's the background on the trial. Tell us what was found.
Yeah, well, bottom line, like you said, the trial was stopped early because overwhelmingly people that took semaglutide had better outcomes. And so in total, the risk of that primary outcome event that you spoke about was 24% lower in the semaglutide group compared to the placebo group. And that was 331 events versus 410 first-time events. And one thing I do want to point out, so this is a composite outcome. So it's not like they just look at things, they combine multiple things. Sometimes people critique that and say, well, they're combining too many things. But this is pretty standard you see in our other kidney outcome trials, like with SGLT2 inhibitors, with the mineralocorticoid receptor agonists. And that's really because if you would wait for just one of these outcomes to show significance, it could take much longer. And we want results. We want to see what happens. That being said, though, several of these individual outcomes were also statistically significant as well. And so, for example, so some of these secondary outcomes, mean eGFR decline was less in the group with semaglutide. And also the risk of major adverse cardiovascular events was 18% lower. And the risk of death from any cause was 20% lower in the semaglutide group. So that's pretty impressive, I would say. And I think really now puts into question, well, where do GLP-1 receptor agonists fit in the whole paradigm of treatment? Because until now, when you look at guidelines for someone with kidney disease and type 2 diabetes, our guidelines are in agreement that SGLT2 inhibitors are the first line diabetes drug. And so I kind of wonder with our next set of guidelines, how that may change in terms of, like, for example, with cardiovascular disease, we have a choice. We can use SGLT2 inhibitors or GLP-1 receptor agonists, because both have shown reductions in cardiovascular disease. So I do wonder how this is going to affect those guidelines. And I would imagine that semaglutide will be going for, or Ozempic brand name, will be going for this indication specifically for people with type 2 diabetes and kidney disease. And
well, absolutely. I mean, they should, right? I mean, this is significant. And I think what this does for us as clinicians is, you know, we have someone who can't tolerate an SGLT2 inhibitor. They ended up with side effect issues. They, for whatever reason, they can't take it. You'd feel really badly sitting in an office looking at someone thinking, gosh, you have protein in your urine and your GFR is starting to drop. And we've done everything we can for your diabetes. And I worry about your kidneys. And now I can look at that person and say, let's make sure we are using a GLP-1 that has demonstrated outcomes and that right now will only be, for the moment, it's only semaglutide. This is the first GLP-1 that has shown this outcome in renal disease. So I think that we can look at it that way and say, okay, but we are doing it. We are offering this. We can do that. The second thing is, of course, where do you and I go next is, well, what about a little bit of SGLT2 inhibitor and a little bit of GLP-1? Or should we be maxing those doses out with tolerability in order to reduce that risk even further? And we don't know those answers. We don't know if we're going to get an exponential effect if we are using some of both versus one or the other, because there are, of course, no head-to-head trials. And so this is really exciting. I think that that this has a potential to do a lot for a lot of people.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point about, would we use SGLT2 inhibitor and GLP-1 receptor agonist? I think for sure for those that need the additional glucose lowering, that makes a lot of sense. What's interesting is, so people in the trial could be on SGLT2 inhibitors. It was only 15.7% in the semaglutide group and 15.5% of the placebo group. And I think part of that is because at the time this trial was started, for those with kidney disease, SGLT2 inhibitors weren't necessarily the standard up here like they are now. We would definitely put people out of that. So it's hard to say about, right, they're an additive. I mean, they have totally different mechanisms of action. So it seems plausible that it would be additive, but we don't know that for sure. And they did actually do a subgroup analysis where they compared results for those that were on SGLT2 inhibitors and to those that weren't. And the group that wasn't, the semaglutide performed better. The group that was, there wasn't statistical significance. But I think the thing to keep in mind is that such a small percentage of people were on the SGLT2 inhibitor. So it just wasn't powered to detect that difference. So we just simply can't say at this point. We also really don't know in terms of like additive effects with finerenone, which also has a totally different mechanism of action as well, with that have additive effects. And now I think we're going to need guidance in clinical practice about, well, which of these classes do we use first, or which should take priority since they haven't gone head to head. And then one other thing I do want to mention is the background use of ACE inhibitors and angiotensin receptor blockers was very good. It was very high. I think it was like close to 90% of people that were on one or the other. And I think that's something important that we should not forget, that people need to be on those drugs. And then we add this to that. So that's still a standard of care that we shouldn't forget as well.
Absolutely. Blood pressure control we just have to do that anytime. I mean, with diabetes, with kidney disease individually, never mind together. The other thing we need to remember with the use of SGLT2 inhibitors, the low numbers are also, remember, we're looking at 28 countries here. So I think that they did a really good job of looking at this internationally, 387 sites, but not all countries have access to all the same medications.
Yeah, and actually, now that I'm looking at this, ACE and ARBs, it's closer to 95%.
Yeah, it was high. Exactly. Yep.
high background use of that. And some other interesting things, 61% of people were taking insulin. But I think that kind of goes to the fact of the progressive nature of type 2 diabetes. The longer someone's had it, the more likely you take insulin.
Right.
These people had kidney disease, so they had diabetes on average for longer, on average for like 15 years or so. So I think that that makes sense in terms of a real world.
You know, my only thing that I would like to have seen is CGM data.
Yes.
I mean, you know, here we are standing on our, you know, director of technology horses, but this is, wouldn't it have been interesting to see before and after continuous glucose sensing data? You know, the challenge with that is it's expensive to add that to a trial. And I recognize that, and I can hear people saying, but, you know, some of the countries that these were done in, it's not available for people with type 2. It would have to be another step and more time. But I would say I would love to have seen that as part of the, you know, even if it was just presented as part of the data set of, you know, before, during and after, time and range, time below, time above range, if there was changes in medications, those kinds of things based on, you know, that outcome.
That would be really interesting. It makes me wonder if they must have data on some people with that. It would be really interesting if that was shared at a later time. Just looking, they did record number of severe hypoglycemic episodes. Those were similar between the groups.
But yes, without CGM, I saw that.
Yeah, it's hard to have a full amount of hypoglycemia. And of course, one of the things I worry about when you add a GLP-1 to someone taking insulin, just making sure that you're decreasing the insulin along with that to just make sure you're reducing that chance of hypoglycemia. But it sounds like at least severe events were similar. So I imagine they were following that, doing that and decreasing the doses as needed.
Well, what a great discussion. And again, this is, you know, there are studies that come out that we talk about and what would happen. But this, I think, is going to change the direction of not only guidance for medical management, but our care every day. I really do. I think this will be an interesting, let's watch our ADA guidelines and see what the next step is.
For sure. Yeah, I think this truly is going to be changing our practice. And I look forward to seeing what the next set of guidelines will look like. And also, I think just the question of how does this apply to other GLP-1 receptor agonists or other incretin agents like tirzepatide. And so it'll be interesting that you see data emerge from those other agents, if this is a class effect versus a single agent. Based on kind of what we've learned, I would anticipate this would be more of a class effect, and just some of the preliminary outcomes or secondary outcomes from other agents like liraglutide and dulaglutide. But of course, we'll see. We have the data to know for sure.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thank you for a great discussion. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. And that concludes this episode of the Diabetes Dialogue.